Argument this morning is United States against Hodge. Mr. Herman.
Good morning. May it please the court. This morning I'd like to discuss two of the serious errors that led to Mr. Kubley's conviction and his enhanced sentence. I'd like to talk about the money laundering conviction, and I'd like to talk about the leader-organizer enhancement that Mr. Kubley received. First, to the money laundering conviction, the government failed to prove a transaction and proceeds in this case. The government tried its case and completed...
Is this an issue different from the one the Supreme Court has now with Shalaba?
Santos? We recognize that this court's holding and recent holding Morales v...
My question is, are you making a different argument from what is being made in the Supreme Court?
Yes, there are issues above and beyond the problem with the distinction between gross income and net profits. Specifically, as to the concern that this court has voiced in Shalaba, Santos, and Malone as to the merger of the underlying predicate offense and with the money laundering offense, that's clear and present in this case. Whereas we just need to look at the superseding indictment, the exact same conduct is alleged as violative of Section 1952, the predicate offense, as well as Section 1956. And the error is manifest in closing argument when the government said, and this is at 665.
Well, that's very common, of course, for the same conduct to violate two federal criminal statutes.
Three or four.
Well, as this court recognizes, as a matter of statutory construction, if the government can prove one set of conduct and lead to two separate conditions, this is a result that should be avoided. And this is what happened in this case. The government, in its closing argument, noted that, and as to count two, the money laundering count, all those overt acts that I'll talk about regarding count one show that the defendant was involved in the conspiracy to commit money laundering as well.
I'm puzzled. And as Judge Posner said, nothing is more common than for one course of conduct to violate multiple statutes. If you, say, sell cocaine, you violated the law against possessing cocaine. You violated the law against distributing cocaine. You violated, right? I could go on for quite some time. And we don't say, gee, that means that you haven't violated all those laws.
That's correct. In this situation, though...
Good that you think the court is correct.
Thank you. In this situation, though, we're dealing also with two separate statutes, and the way the government tried its case and presented its superseding indictment completely relieved it of any... I'm sorry.
Talking over the court doesn't help. Let me ask a variant of Judge Posner's question. Are you making an argument related to the one that's before the Supreme Court in Cuellar?
I'm not familiar with that. I'd be happy to submit supplemental briefing.
Well, if you're not familiar with it, then you don't know whether you're making such an argument. But one of the questions that I'm interested in, perhaps the prosecutor will think of this, is whether this appeal should be held for Cuellar as well as for Santos, or maybe instead of holding it for Santos.
I'd be happy to submit supplemental briefs on the issue if this court desires.
If you don't know what Cuellar is, I don't want supplemental briefing on your position relative to it.
Okay.
You obviously aren't making the Cuellar argument if you don't know what it is.
I am making an argument, though, that there's a separate and distinct above Santos and above the merger argument that I just made, which also requires reversal or vacation of Mr. Kubley's money laundering conviction. And that is that the government essentially failed to prove elements of the 1956 offense. Those two specific elements would be the knowing and the in fact portions of the money laundering statute, where Mr. Kubley had to know that the money came from some unlawful source and that money in fact had to come from the predicate offense here.
Is that separate from your argument about the... The 404B evidence?
It's totally separate and distinct.
Wasn't that evidence intended to show that he knew the source of the money?
It was to show how he knew how the operation worked, not necessarily the source of the money. This is a problem dealing specifically...
How is that different? I mean, then...
Because
this is the characteristic mode of doing business of a prostitution... massage parlor, then he knows the money comes from that, doesn't he?
It's different because we're dealing with different issues of proof as to the 1956 conviction. And those, if we take a look at the business checking account in this case, there are three streams of money that were in it. There was cash, which as a matter of law cannot support a money laundering conviction. There was money from the front-end credit card swipes, which cannot show that Mr. Kubli knew that the money used in subsequent transactions was from an unlawful source. And then there's the secondary or the back-end credit card swipes, which was the only transaction, only receipts from only those transactions could lead to the 1952 predicate activity. The government didn't distinguish between any of these streams of money when it said that everything, all the expenses paid off the business checking accounts are operational expenses. Those were crucial distinctions that the government had to make to show that the money, in fact, came from the specified unlawful activity. That wasn't made. And as a result, Mr. Kubli was convicted based on transactions drawn from money that was not unlawful under the statute. This is an additional reason for vacating Mr. Kubli's conviction for the money laundering issue. If there are no further questions on the money laundering issue, I'd like to turn to the leader organizer enhancement that Mr. Kubli received. The district court's ruling, finding that Mr. Kubli was a leader or organizer of this operation is clearly erroneous. And to see why, we need to look no further than the district court's own findings on the record. For example, the district court noted that Mr. Kubli ran the spa. The district court found that co-defendants Moser and Park ran the spa sort of as theirs. This finding is wholly inconsistent with one that Mr. Kubli led, organized, controlled, or influenced the operation. The testimony in the record from co-defendant Moser said that Mr. Kubli could not have control, said that Mr. Kubli had no influence over her. She took no advice from anyone during the operation. The pre-sentence report found that both co-defendants Moser and Park ran day-to-day operations of the spa. Again, inconsistent with the finding of control or leadership. The district court also found that in support of the four-level enhancement that Mr. Kubli knew what was going on and he followed what went on. Knowing and following what goes on or observing what goes on of a criminal operation is not tantamount to leading, controlling, or influencing that organization. This court said as much in Shue. The district court also found that there was a larger claim to profits that Mr. Kubli had, which warranted the four-level enhancement. This is also unsupported by the evidence and contradicted by the evidence. All Mr. Kubli received was $3,500 in rent, which was totally per month, totally independent of how much profits the spa raked in. The PSR noted that Mr. Kubli received only these rent payments. Moser said that she never split the profits with Mr. Kubli. And the $3,500 on rent, taking into weighing that against what both Moser and Parks that they took in, was about just about 15% of the total monthly take. That's not a larger share of the profits. As one last point as to recruiting, Mr. Kubli never recruited anyone. Moser, the evidence will show that Moser came to this spa on her own accord. Park was recruited by co-defendant Hodge, and the prostitutes were recruited in turn by Park, Hodge, and Moser. At this time, I'll cede the podium to Mr. Brown, counsel for Ms. Hodge. If there are no further questions.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Herman. Mr. Brown.
May it please the court, I'm David Brown, court-appointed counsel for Hoon Hodge. Very quickly, we've consolidated our briefs here, and the argument that I would just like to point out was Ms. Hodge believes that Judge Reinhardt improperly applied the two-level enhancement by not following the prescriptions of Section 1B1.5. When they went to the base level offense, which was the underlying prostitution section, we believe that Section 1.1.5 required the judge to stay with that section and not jump back to the money laundering section of 2S1.1.
What's the actual language on which you're relying?
It's a specific language set out in Mr. Herman's brief.
Just tell me which language you're relying on.
specific language of 1.1.5, which states that when you use the guideline, or when you go to another section to determine the guideline, you must stay with that section and use the entire offense guideline from that section.
Can't be more concrete than that about which language you're relying on and why it helps you. Right. The question is whether, if you look at 1B1.5, B1 says an instruction to use the offense level means, et cetera, the base offense level, specific offense characteristics, cross-references, and special instructions, except as provided in subsection 2, which says an instruction to use a particular subsection or table from another offense guideline refers only to the subsection or table. So the question is, within which domain are we? Are we within B1 or B2? Now, I'm hoping that you have an argument about which one we're within and why we're within that domain.
Our argument is that we were within the B1.
And why?
Because of just the preciseness of the language, that you must follow the language as it's stated in the guideline. I know the counsel's arguing that somehow gives people that commit money laundering and prostitution some kind of boon here, that they're not being adequately punished for the money laundering. But that's the way the guideline appears to read in its plain reading. I would defer the rest of my time on this to counsel for his rebuttal. Looks like we're out. Any other questions?
Okay, thank you very much.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Michael Osparo on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start off with the money laundering issue. It's a sufficiency of the evidence argument. And
which money laundering issue? We have a Xialaba Santos issue, it seems. Do we also have a Cuellar issue?
According to the defendants, no, Judge. And you asked the question whether...
The defendant didn't say we don't have a Cuellar issue. The defendant said he had never heard of Cuellar, even though the Supreme Court has granted certiorari in both Santos and Cuellar, and they'll be argued in tandem to consider problems about the scope of the money laundering offense. Now, one possibility is that this case is also within the scope of Cuellar. So what's your position on that?
I'm not familiar with Cuellar, Judge. Oh. We believe that it is within the scope of Santos. However, if the court agrees with us on the facts of the case and that we prove that there was a reinvestment of net proceeds, and we fully believe that we established that at trial, then we believe this court can decide the case even before the Supreme Court decides Santos. On the other hand, the court...
I don't understand that at all. The distinction between gross and net is not whether you pay your costs of business before or after you get receipts. And that's not... has nothing to do with the distinction between gross and net. And in fact, on your explanation in this case, Xialaba was wrongly decided, because in Xialaba, the defendants opened the video poker machine, took the coins from inside, and used the coins to pay their expenses. So they used the proceeds, they used the gross proceeds of the offense to pay costs of doing business and ended up with net. That's not, so what you're saying in this case is not a distinction of Xialaba, it's just Xialaba all over again.
We disagree. Xialaba left open the possibility that the government could prove promotion by showing that there was a reinvestment of net profit or net proceeds. And after you take out the operational expenses, for example, the salary or the cut that the working girls got here, or utilities, and you got to what you were going to use for promotional expenses, in this case future rent, future advertising, then that was taken out of net proceeds. So we think that it fits within what Xialaba left open, the reinvestment of net proceeds, Judge.
How much of the income, let's say revenues, of the massage parlor were illegal, or were, you know, for prostitution rather than for...
How much were illegal?
Well, I don't know. How much came from prostitution? Well, I guess that's illegal, yeah. So.
Both Acne and Mosier and...
Since we're not in Nevada, I guess it's illegal.
Yeah. Acne and Mosier and Kyung Cha Park both testified at trial, and they testified that I think about 60 to 70% of the proceeds came from prostitution. There was some legitimate business being conducted there, but the majority of it came from prostitution.
So did you partition the legal and the illegal in some way?
No, and I know that's a point that that counsel made, that that's something that we should have done, but both the legal and illegal proceeds from the credit card receipts, legal proceeds being the front money, and if you didn't go any further, that's all that customer would pay for, and then the illegal being the back money, the second swipe, both of them were commingled into the business checking accounts. It would be an impossible burden for us to establish that a particular check that was written to, say, Wisconsin...
Why couldn't you use the 60 or 70% estimate?
In order to establish a...
An estimate of how much of the revenue is illegal.
Well, I suppose you could, based upon Mosier and Park's testimony, but I don't think you have to do that, because in order to establish the money laundering offense, and the Baker case, for example, tells us, although in a forfeiture context, that the commingling of funds doesn't matter. It's difficult to parse out the legal proceeds from the illegal proceeds.
It doesn't sound very difficult to have the 60 to 70% estimate.
If you use the simple percentage, then I guess that would be the easiest way to do it. But to say that 60% of one check that's going to, say, a Wisconsin advertiser comes from illegal proceeds and the other 40%...
Why do you have to be that specific? I don't understand.
That would be a...
If the amount laundered, whether it's net or gross, if that's pertinent to the sentence, why can't you just have an estimate of how much of the total income was illegal?
Mm-hmm. Although it wouldn't be pertinent to the sentence here, because the defendants were sentenced based upon what the underlying offense was, essentially count one. So the value of the laundered funds didn't make a difference here.
The value of the laundered funds didn't make a difference.
For sentencing purposes.
And it shouldn't have made a difference for the substantive offense either, all problems about Cuellar to one side, because in order to convict for the substantive offense, all you have to show is there's $1 of net profit. And I would think that would be the easiest thing in the world. I don't understand why you deliberately court problems with Shialaba and Santos by focusing on the gross rather than showing that they had $1 of net profit.
Judge, but my understanding of Shialaba is that you have to show that that $1 of net profit was used to promote the illegal business.
You have to have the dollar of net profit, and then you have to launder it. Shialaba is about net versus gross, and Cuellar is about what it means to launder the money. Right? The reason I've been asking about Cuellar is that it appears to be the prosecution's theory in this case that using your criminal proceeds to pay your own rent is a form of money laundering. That is, it's consistent with the approach of the Northern District of Illinois that if you commit an offense and do anything other than burn the currency afterward, you have also committed money laundering. And that's what the Fifth Circuit held en banc in Cuellar, and the Supreme Court has granted certiorari to determine whether that is correct.
I would agree with your... Well, I'm not going to go so far as to agree with your summary of the Northern District's position, but certainly our position here is to say that the defendants did commit money laundering by using what we are calling the net proceeds for future advertising and future rent, and that they are net proceeds because they came from...
Money was being used in Cuellar, by the way, to buy the next load of drugs.
I'd like to move on now to the leadership issue.
What if the money were used to buy works of art? Wouldn't that be a clearer case of money laundering?
Yes.
Well, if you're...
It'd be a real thing.
Right. Then you're getting into the concealment aspect of money laundering.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Yes.
So why do you make much of their investing it in promotional activities? Why is that?
Because that's the way that they were laundering the money. They were promoting the business.
But why is it important to you what they did with the money? In fact, if they put it back into the business, that's less laundering-like than if they put it into a legitimate. That's the legitimate activity, right?
But there is the promotion prong of the money laundering statute.
I understand promotion prong of a money laundering statute. Your position seems to be anything they do with the money is...
Other than burn it or eat it.
Right, is laundering. It doesn't matter whether it's promotion or whether it's anything else, right? So what's the promotional prong?
Well, I think the theory here is that it was promotion because...
Yes, I know, but why does it matter what the purpose of the reinvestment of the money is?
Because it's something we have to establish.
You have to establish that something happened to the money. But why does it matter? You seem to think that if you can show it's for promotion rather than for buying works of art, that would somehow strengthen your case, which actually would weaken it.
I'm not suggesting it would strengthen our case. It's just not the way it was charged here. If they would have taken the money and bought works of art to conceal it, then perhaps we would have had a concealment case. But that didn't fit.
But do you really think it's germane whether they used it for promotion? Do you have to, in your indictment, do you have to indicate what the use of the reinvested proceeds was?
Well, I think this gets to counsel's first point, which is suggesting that somehow there was a merging of offenses here. And we don't believe that was the case at all, because the first offense charged a conspiracy to use interstate facilities, the credit card machines attached to the interstate telephone lines, and the money laundering conspiracy is a completely separate offense based upon the financial transactions, the writing of the checks to promote the business.
But why is it important that it promoted the business rather than did something else?
I don't know how to answer that other than to say that it's a separate offense, and it shows the complete picture
of what
they were doing.
What difference does it make whether they'd used it to promote the business or buy more credit card machines, right? Would that make a difference? If they used it to buy another swiper?
Well, I think that would be promoting the business as well, Judge.
I don't understand your obsession with promotion. I do not understand what... I don't understand what your conception of money laundering is, actually. No idea.
Anything other than burning or eating the proceeds of a crime.
Is that correct?
I disagree with that.
Well, then what is
okay,
your...
Okay, what can you do with the proceeds of a crime other than burning or eating the currency that is not money laundering?
Well, the example I was going to give would be hiding it under your mattress, but I suppose... The answer would be that would be concealment. Although I can't imagine...
I bet you would say putting it under the mattress was concealing the proceeds. Yep.
So, in fact, you have no... You said that Judge Easterbrook was incorrect when he characterized
right.
your position, but in fact it is correct. It is your position.
Conceptually...
But don't use words like that.
Well... But,
that's a word that simply conceals meaning.
But well, I am going to use
words of one syllable.
Conceptually, I agree with you. However, realistically, Judge, even the Northern District of Illinois, no U.S. Attorney's Office is going to charge money laundering concealment when somebody is hiding the money under a mattress.
I'm lost completely.
Is there any concrete example where one would rely on anything other than prosecutorial discretion to say that it is not money laundering? Don't feel abashed that you can't come up with one. This isn't the first time I've asked an assistant U.S. attorney from your district this question and never gotten any answer other than, well, if you do burn it, it's not money laundering. Although it would probably be prosecuted as a violation of the Clean Air Act.
Judge, I'm not going to tell you that anything other than burning the money is not money laundering. However, in this case, what the defendants did...
Yeah, that's the retreat, right? Retreat to this case. Let me ask you about the 404B This is pretty prejudicial, showing him patronizing the poorhouse. But was there something about the rapid sequence of credit card transactions? Is that something that he would have observed in the Rainbow Parlor, whatever it was? Is that what made it appropriate evidence to show knowledge of the prostitution activities in his bar, or whatever it was, his massage parlor?
The evidence at trial as to how the Royal Health Spa worked, which came from Akian Mosher in Kyungcha Park, was that there were double swipes. The first swipe was up front.
Yes, I understand. Now, what had he observed that in the Rainbow Room or whatever it was?
He would have had to, because the first swipe, as testified to at trial, would happen when the customer came into the business and happened up front.
So any customer who used the prostitution service would have his card swiped twice within, an hour or so. Is that the idea?
Yes, Judge.
So he would have had to know that.
Okay. Yes.
Was that explained to the jury, that was why the testimony about his patronizing this Rainbow place was germane to his knowledge?
It was, Judge. In closing arguments, that's the argument that we made.
Okay, thanks.
Counsel, can you, can any estimate be made of the proportion of proceeds from illegal funding as opposed to the front-end legal funding? In other words, were the second swipes for substantially more money than the first swipes?
Yes, the estimates that were given at trial were $80, $120, $200 estimates for the second swipe, which was above and beyond the $40 or $60 front swipe, which was for a period of time, $40 for half hour,
and
$60 for 1 hour.
And what kind of evidence do you have as to how many of the individuals who walk through those doors let their credit card be swiped twice as opposed to once?
That came from Akian Mosher in Kyungcha Park, and I think in answering Judge Posner's question, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% of the customers.
Can an argument be made that, in effect, the legal part of this business was a front for the illegal part of this business?
Sure.
Just as an irrelevant detail, does Rockford do anything to try to curtail this prostitution activity? Was there something like 500 or more massage parlors?
I don't know about 500, Judge. That I've lived there my whole life. That seems like an awfully high number.
Maybe I'm confused.
This case, there were investigations into multiple massage parlors into this case, which led to five separate indictments, and they had to do with seven massage parlors which were operating as fronts for prostitution.
Why isn't this a local problem for Rockford? Why is the federal government interested in prostitution?
Because there were violations of federal law, Judge.
I know, everything violates federal law, but it's not as if this is some international prostitution ring that a local city or a state couldn't deal with. I mean, presumably the U.S. Attorney's offices have limited resources, and prostitution's, when it doesn't involve crossing state lines and stuff, transporting women... Why is it of federal interest?
Certainly that was an aspect of the...
Can't the locals deal with this? If they want to, probably don't want to, right?
If they wanted to, certainly they could, Judge.
So if they don't want to, they're probably thriving business in Rockford, supporting the Rockford economy.
This may be the tax base of Rockford.
So if they don't care, why does the Department of Justice care?
They did care. The Rockford Police Department came to us and asked for help. And it was because there were a lot of illegal aliens that were living and working at these massage parlors. There were hundreds of thousands of dollars that were going through these massage parlors on a monthly basis, and they needed the resources of the federal government to help them investigate, and that's why we stepped in.
All right, thank you. That was interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Herman? That's guaranteed. Your time is short.
Thank you. Following up on Judge Ripple's comment as to the front-end charges serving as a front for the money laundering, that may be germane to the forfeiture, the sums forfeited, but as to what's necessary to convict for Section 1956, if somebody comes in and just buys from the front end legitimate massage spa services, it's not sufficient to convict for 1956 because it's not unlawful. It's not revenue, receipts from an unlawful source. And as to the estimates of 60 to 70% of the income coming from prostitution activity, we also have to parse out how much comes from cash, and that wasn't done. Cash cannot support the money laundering conviction here because it doesn't represent receipts that are in fact from the specific unlawful activity, the secondary credit card swipes. These distinctions weren't made at trial at all. The government lumped them all together and then on top of that exacerbated it by ignoring Shalaba. As to briefly the 404B evidence, our argument is that whatever happened in closing arguments or limited instructions that were given does not cure the fact that the evidence in the first instance was not sufficient to show that he knew of the double swipes. As the record shows, Moser basically looked at credit card receipts and read his name off of them.
I don't understand. If he patronized this prostitution, this brothel, I guess, then he would be familiar with the fact you have to, you know, have your card swipe when you come in and then later when you decide what the prostitution part of it.
Well, our argument is that Judge Reinhardt required that the almost always showing that he's using credit card swipes, and the evidence just didn't show that, and the government ran with it by saying that the Rainbow Spa was a training ground for his future operations, evidence that was exacerbated by the fact that he met his wife and co-defendant.
How you're responding to my question. Yes, in his patronage of the Rainbow Spa, he would learn about this, what the significance of having two consecutive credit card orders in the same place, you know, with just a short time between them.
It just didn't go, it wasn't sufficient enough according to 404B to show that he...
I don't understand. Why isn't that sufficient?
I mean,
or at least, why isn't it probative?
There was no proof that he was actually witnessing the credit card swipes.
What do you mean witnessing? If he's a customer, his credit card, he has to give his credit card to the madam, doesn't he?
And then he looks at the statement and sees there are two separate items on it.
Even given that, we think that the prejudicial...
Yes, assigned two slips.
The prejudicial effect...
that's a separate point, the prejudicial effect.
If I may turn to the two-level enhancement...
Time has expired. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Brown? You have a few seconds, I think. Thank you very much. We thank both Mr. Herman and Mr. Brown for their willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance both to your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.